Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. In May, a leading earthquake scientist announced that the southern San Andreas Fault is, quote, locked, loaded, and ready to roll. This news has brought attention to California's lack of an early warning system for earthquakes and the need to implement one. The California budget that passed this past July included new funds for an earthquake early warning system, and the allocation of money represented a change of heart for Governor Jerry Brown, who previously had tried to have such a system built out of a combination of federal and private funds only. California trails Japan and other earthquake-prone areas in its earthquake warning abilities, but with its unique access to technology and innovative thinkers, has an opportunity to be at the cutting edge of developing such a system. So how much warning can make a difference in outcomes when it comes to earthquakes? And how will a warning be transmitted to reach the most people? And how is the state hoping that you could be part of the solution? To discuss all this and more, I am pleased to be joined in the studio by Dr. Richard Allen. He's director at the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory and professor and chair of the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley. He's an expert in earthquake alerting systems, developing methodologies to detect earthquakes and issue warnings prior to shaking. His research has been featured in Science, Nature, Scientific American, The New York Times, and more. Welcome, Richard.
Great to be with you.
And by phone, we're joined by Dr. Harvey Feinberg. He's president of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. He is the former presidential chair for 2014-15 as a visiting professor at UCSF, and he served as president of the Institute of Medicine from 2002 to 2014 and as provost of Harvard University from 1997 to 2001, following 13 years as the dean of Harvard School of Public Health. Welcome, Harvey Feinberg.
It's a pleasure to be with you and also with you, Richard.
Hi.
And we invite you, our listeners, as always, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, and you can dial 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at CityVisionsKALW. If you have questions or comments about earthquake early warning systems, earthquake preparedness, or earthquake risks, share your thoughts in our conversation this evening with our guests. So, Richard Allen, I wanted to start with a little bit of a science lesson about earthquakes, and specifically about how the science of how we understand earthquakes is relevant to this topic tonight about early warning systems.
Sure. So I think we're all aware of the earthquake hazard here in California. We all know that we're living close to some pretty hazardous faults, the San Andreas Fault being the primary one that people think of. But it's actually a system of multiple faults that's throughout the San Francisco Bay Area, and for that matter, down in Southern California as well. And so the reason that we can start thinking about earthquake early warning, which is about rapidly detecting an earthquake and providing a warning before the shaking arrives, is because when an earthquake is underway, it emits energy that travels at different speeds. And the energy that does a lot of the damage is what we think call the S waves. It travels more slowly. There's actually some energy that travels more rapidly called P waves that radiates out from the fault at the same time. So by using sensitive instrumentation, we can record that first arriving P wave energy. We can use it to assess how big the earthquake is, where it's located, and then we can predict the amount of shaking that is going to follow with the S waves. And so that's the science behind earthquake early warning.
And so this is, you know, I have to say, to me, kind of news. I'd never thought we would actually ever be able to know an earthquake was coming. I mean, we could talk about other types of climatic disasters, right, that we have forecasts for. But this is not necessarily a forecast system, right? This is more of a seconds to respond and get ourselves to be safe.
That's right. So when we think about forecasts, we often talk about sort of lower probability events. There's a 50% chance of rain. And this is not a forecast in that sense. When we issue an early warning, there's a near certainty that there's going to be strong shaking. And so in that sense, it's not a forecast. It's also important to make the distinction between earthquake early warning and what people typically think of earthquake prediction. Earthquake prediction being saying, you know, next Wednesday, there's going to be a large magnitude earthquake. We cannot do that. And most seismologists would agree that's not going to happen in the foreseeable future. But what we can do is when the earthquake starts, we can take advantage of this time between when the earth starts to move and when we feel the shaking. And that's where the warning comes from. And as you mentioned, we're talking about seconds, tens of seconds, best case scenario, a minute or a couple of minutes of warning.
So people might ask the next question here, which is, well, what is a few seconds? What does a minute get you? It doesn't seem like a lot of time.
That's right. But in fact, it gets you a great deal. The first thing that people think about when they think about earthquakes and warnings is, what do I personally do to reduce the likelihood that I am going to be injured? And the answer to that is very simple. You move to a safe place in the room that you're already in. You and I would get under this table that we're sat around right now. People move to safe places away from windows, away from things that may fall down. And that just takes a few seconds. And we estimate that with everybody gets a warning and everybody takes a response to that warning, we could approximately halve the number of injuries in an earthquake. So that's a substantial saving right there. The other kinds of applications are automated response. So systems that are running that we can automatically slow them down, put them into a safe mode. Great example of that is train systems. The BART train system here in the Bay Area was one of the first groups to implement an automated response to the early warning system that we have right now.
And so say more about that. What would happen in that case?
So in the case of the BART train, the BART train systems are actually all computer controlled. And so they get the alert, and when the shaking is expected to be above some threshold, they automatically slow and stop the train. So the trains immediately start to decelerate. And as I say, they implemented very early, although the system we have right now, it's still a prototype system, but they implemented it a few years ago, understanding that it was still under development. And the reason it's so valuable is that by slowing and stopping trains, you can potentially prevent a train from derailing during an earthquake. And that obviously will have a huge benefit in terms of reducing the number of injuries in an earthquake.
So what are some other examples of what an early warning system can do in terms of decreasing the risk of injury?
So you can stop elevators at the nearest floor. So hopefully we could, if you have an earthquake, for example, in a busy time during the workday, it could be literally thousands of people that are trapped in elevators, each of which will need two or more emergency response personnel to release them. So you can imagine how many response personnel will be tied up releasing thousands of people from elevators. If elevators stop and open their doors at the nearest floor, then those folks are not trapped. Other kinds of applications are moving data around into a secure storage. All of these kinds of things, slowing and stopping cars, for example, when you get a warning. As you start to look into the future, and we have an environment that is ever more interconnected, you can imagine all kinds of applications for early warning. Self-driving cars, for example, that are clearly on their way, could slow and stop and pull over to the side of the highway. You can stop cars from entering bridges and other unsafe kinds of environments. The number of applications is really, you know, it's as broad as just people's imagination when they think about how they can make their environment around them at work and at home safer places.
And I read somewhere even it could be a warning to surgeons, for example, to say, pause the surgery right here.
That's the one that everybody relates to, the tectonically shaking scalpel, I believe it has been called. But yes, if you're in surgery and the surgeon gets a few seconds warning, can just step back, put the LASIK surgery on hold until the earthquake shaking is over.
So it seems pretty obvious that that we could benefit from this based on what you've described. If we're to take your estimates of the harm averted to be accurate, so let me turn now to Harvey Feinberg to say, Harvey Feinberg, we understand that this has been something we've needed, and other parts of the world, like Japan, Mexico, have implemented these types of systems, but we haven't. Why?
We've not implemented it in part because the technology needed to be developed further and refined. It needed to be tested locally, and it needed to be identified and utilized in a way that we could be more confident that it would work. But we did learn a lot from the experience in other places. In fact, it was after the catastrophic earthquake and tsunami in Japan in March of 2011 that the Moore Foundation first convened a group And Richard, I believe you were part of that early discussion about what could be done for the United States. And that's what really inaugurated the support that the foundation provided to UC Berkeley, Caltech, University of Washington, and through them to others to begin developing the prototypes that Richard described.
So what are you saying, perhaps, about the technology that has been implemented in other parts of the world if you're saying that the technology really wasn't ready for us as Americans?
Well, it's not that I'm judging what was in place in other parts of the world, but it's also evident that although Japan had early warning, they also did not have all of the adjustments and adaptation that was needed to make a fully effective system. At the same time, the U.S. Simply had not invested in this particular technology in a way that would allow us to begin harvesting the benefit in case, or we should say when, the next earthquake occurs.
So to you, Richard Allen, in this situation, is something better than waiting till you get it absolutely right?
That's a great question. I mean, we have to make a decision. At what point do we have this honed enough that it's ready for public consumption? And there's no question that this system will only continue to improve as long as we continue to work on the system, as long as we continue to improve the algorithms, as long as we collect more data from actually having earthquakes, the system will always improve. But at the same time, it comes a point when you say, you know, this is too important. What we have right now is good enough to get started. And that is the point that we are at now, that we've concluded and all of the other groups involved have agreed that we are at the point that this is good enough. And that's why I think we've been able to start moving towards a public system. And if I could just comment on what Harvey just mentioned and the role of the Moore Foundation, he's being very modest in his description of what the challenges were. The issues were that we had been working, several scientists in the U.S. had been working towards early warning for a number of years, seeing the potential benefit. We then had this massive magnitude 9 earthquake in Japan where early warning did work and provided warnings to people, obviously having a positive impact. But what we were struggling with, we the scientists involved, was how do we get over this hump of really demonstrating the value of this here in the U.S.? It wasn't enough that there were systems in other countries. We needed to get over this hump. And that's where the Moore Foundation stepped in and started to provide the support we needed, a significant investment, but an investment to get us over that hump to the point where we can prove the technology and start moving towards a public system. And the fact that there is now public money being put into building this system, both federal money and state money, is testimony to the value of that contribution from the Moore Foundation.
And my understanding, Harvey Fineberg, is that the Moore Foundation also is funding the USGS, the U.S. Geological Service, which is a government entity, correct?
It is.
So
it's really a part of the original grants to the universities, because one of the things that we were very eager to assure is that the developments all up and down the coast in California and Washington and Oregon would be compatible one to another. And the USGS came in actually with a relatively modest amount of resources required and was under $1 million for their effort to coordinate the development across the several states. They were in a very good position to do it as a U.S. Entity, and at the same time, because of their own budgetary constraints, they did not have the flexible money, even at that amount, to be able to carry out this function. And so the advantage of private philanthropy in a case like this, committed to science and development, is that we were able to move more quickly with greater flexibility to put the resources in the hands of the scientists and literally bring in the government to help in a coordinating role, to a point where I think now not only has the system been brought to this advanced prototype stage, but we're in a much stronger position to implement it in a consistent and effective way all up and down the coast and eventually across all 39 states that have seismic risk in the U.S.
So I'm going to harp a little bit on this funding issue because it's relevant to the conversation that moves forward, which is even the 10 or so, is it billion dollars that
million?
Million?
No, it's a million with a little
it's
M.
It's a little M. That's what I thought. That Jerry Brown has secured is for some initial funding. It's not for the maintenance and operation of the. Why are we as the United States so resistant to putting money to this effort? And I'm going to ask each of you to give your opinion on this. Start with you, Harvey Feinberg.
I think that it's really more a matter of demonstration and proof of concept. This is not really insurance investment. This is prepayment to prevent expenses and loss of life that are predictably going to occur. The only question is exactly when. And so it's not really a hard decision politically. A poll that was done in March of this year showed in California, 5 out of 6 voters supported the idea of investing in this effort, and more than 62% strongly supported the idea. So it's really just a matter, I think, of overcoming the inertia of political public decision making to do something that is obviously in the public interest, a tremendous best buy in terms of value, and a very ready scientific standard that can now be put in place.
But with the lack of prediction of when the next earthquake will actually come, perhaps you can't use it to get reelected. what do you think here, Richard Allen?
I think that was spot on. That was pretty much the comment I was going to be making, is that I think this is very the hesitation about prioritizing, that's how I see it, prioritizing funding for early warning. It does come down to the issue of, we don't know when the next earthquake is going to be. There's no question there are lots of very high priorities for spending public money. And so it's difficult to fault politicians for hesitating over this when they don't know when the next earthquake is going to be. At the same time, as Harvey says, there's no question now with all of the work that's been done over the course of the last few years, it is clearly going to pay for itself. We don't know quite when it's going to pay for itself, and we just hope that it doesn't have to pay for itself until it's fully operational and everybody gets the warnings.
And why did Jerry Brown blink, as it were? Why now? Why has he decided it's finally time for California to put up some money?
Well, I mean, I think that the time when he said no was when the first legislation in California was being passed, was in 2013. Alex Padilla, the senator at the time, was the one who introduced it. Very forward-looking legislation to bring a public earthquake early warning system to the state. It was a very different time in terms of the fiscal situation in the state, and I think there was pressure not to add any additional general fund commitments on any of the legislation at that time. And so that's why there was no public funding at the time. The budget situation is a little easier at this point, and so I think that's why Jerry Brown decided now was the time to actually start putting some money behind this desire to have a system, which is obviously great news for all of us.
And Harvey Feinberg, from other press that has been out there in the last year, it seems like the entire West Coast, Oregon, Washington, are also at risk. Different fault lines here, but risk at risk. Perhaps not exactly the same level of risk. Are Jerry Brown's actions getting politicians up in Oregon and Washington to also pay more attention to this?
I don't know the answer to that, but I hope the answer is yes. One of the secondary investments that we've made with the University of Washington, for example, is to help them develop a superior system that would be sea-based to do early detection for tsunami in a way analogous to what we're talking about in earthquake. Of course, the two are intimately connected. But the notion that every state at risk ought to pay attention, ought to be prepared to make the same kind of investment in earthquake early warning that any public authority would make in security, in fire protection, in any of the needed protections of public safety. All of these investments ought to be thought of in the same broad category of collective public responsibility to ensure the safety of our population. And in that spirit, now that the technology is ripe and ready, as Richard says, also continuously to be improved, but still good enough to make it worthwhile, I hope every state leader that's affected, certainly up and down the West Coast, as well as our federal officials, will see their way clear to provide the core support to enable this to be up and running and in monitoring in a continuing way.
Did you want to add something there, Richard Allen?
Yeah, I think that the other states, they are also starting to take action. It's sort of interesting to watch over time. There's a sort of back and forth situation where one group will make a contribution, another state it starts to fall behind, and so they catch up. I mean, it's sort of a, you know, somebody once described it to me, everybody wants to be first to be second kind of situation. but I, you know, the point is that, as I said at the beginning, I think we really are over the hump. This technology has proven its capability. The various public entities that need to provide support to build this full West Coast system are all starting to contribute. So I think we're in a really good place in that a few years from now, we can expect to have a public early warning system.
Great. In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're talking about developing an earthquake early warning system here for California and the West Coast with our guests here in the studio with me, Dr. Richard Allen, director of the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory and professor and chair of the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley, and by phone, Dr. Harvey Feinberg, president of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, which is a major private funder of California's earthquake early warning system. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you feel an earthquake early warning system is a good use of state funds? Do you have questions about earthquakes and earthquake preparedness for our guests? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So before we get into hearing more about the technology, because I think it's pretty interesting to unravel that a little bit more. Richard Allen, I wanted to ask you to kind of help us get put this in context. How does early earthquake warning fit into the whole suite of things that we can do to decrease the damage from earthquakes? And so, for example, seismically retrofitting structures, or individual prep, and how people can take care of themselves after an earthquake, and disaster prep and emergency response. In terms of cost, in terms of impact, where does early warning fit in?
Yeah, so let's be very clear. Earthquake early warning is not the panacea for the earthquake problem. Having earthquake early warning does allow us to reduce the impact of earthquakes, but it does not solve the problem. If I was to sort of prioritize the approaches that we need to take to reduce the impact of earthquakes, there's no question the first is building standards. And so making sure that the buildings that we have are able to withstand shaking, by which I mean they don't collapse, that is the most important thing you can do when it comes to earthquake safety. Bottom line is it's buildings collapsing that kills people in earthquakes. If you can build buildings that don't collapse, then you just significantly reduce the impact in terms of fatalities in an earthquake. And we're very fortunate here in California that we do have great building codes. They've been in place for a while. They do also continue to get updated. But so we're in pretty good shape. Not all buildings are safe, but many buildings are safe. The kinds of homes that most people live in, single family wood frame homes, are actually very safe buildings. So we're in a very good place there, but of course we could still do better. So buildings that are not up to code, up to standard, then they need to be retrofit. That was one of the things on your list. The other things that we can do, and it's very important, I should pause and say, people should think about where they live and where they work. Those are the two places that people spend most time. How safe is the building you live in? How safe is the building that you work in? After that, the next thing that everybody should be doing is having a plan for earthquake, for when an earthquake happens, a plan for how they're going to meet up with their families. That's going to be, of course, the first thing they're going to be concerned about. And also have a plan to how they are going to survive 3 to 5 days. In Hurricane Katrina, it took 5 days for responders to get to many people. So that gives you a sense of how long you may be on your own for, how long you may need a water supply for, other kinds of supplies. There's plenty of websites where you can find out what you need for an earthquake plan. So those are the two things that are clearly key. Earthquake early warning is now just an additional layer of protection, if you like, that we can add to this to reduce the number of injuries and reduce perhaps the cost of earthquakes, the amount of damage that is done in earthquakes. And as I said earlier, based on estimates of the number of injuries or the types of injuries in both the Loma Prieta earthquake and the Northridge earthquake, we estimate that if everybody gets to a safe place, like being under a sturdy table, we can halve the number of injuries. So that's, a substantial reduction in the number of injuries. And so therefore, of course, these are fewer people that need emergency responders, hospitals, and things like that.
And how does the cost compare? If you look at, seismically retrofitting, the costs of individually being prepared and than the early warning system?
Well, so I'll tell you first of all the cost of the public early warning system. The USGS with the university partners estimated that the cost of building the early warning system would be about $38 million. That's for the entire West Coast. And then the cost of operating it on an annual basis would be about $16 million. So that's the estimated cost for the public early warning system for the entire West Coast. So if we compare that to the cost of retrofitting buildings, again, I want to emphasize that I do not believe for a minute earthquake early warning should be a preference over retrofitting a building. But I know, for example, on the Berkeley campus, which has gone through a process of retrofitting almost all of its buildings, the cost of retrofitting buildings is typically between $10 and $100 million for a single building. So it's a much larger number. There's no question earthquake early warning is cheap, but that doesn't mean it replaces retrofitting buildings.
But at least it gives us a sense of scale here, right, about how you think about these things. Anything to add there, Harvey Feinberg, about how we should be thinking about this in terms of other things that should be prioritized? Again, if we're looking for reasons why people don't want to put money towards this, is there a way to really think about the cost effectiveness of earthquake early warning that we haven't already talked about?
Well, I like very well Richard's description of where early warning fits into the whole array of preparedness and readiness for earthquake, personally, as businesses, places of work, places of education, public facilities, all of the infrastructure that's needed. And when you think about that context and you think about the cost of retrofitting even a single physical structure, the cost of early warning is modest by comparison to the totality of pre-investment costs, never mind what an earthquake damage would itself still require. But early warning is modest relative to the other investments we're making by code, by law, and by policy. And so put in that context, this really does look like a Best Buy advantage for the public.
All right. And actually, this issue of retrofitting and the safety of buildings being the top priority leads me to an email from Carolyn in Berkeley, who says, how can San Francisco allow the Millennium Tower, which is sinking? Won't an unstable building like it kill people?
You're looking at me?
I'm looking at you, the seismologist.
I say that I'm a seismologist. I'm not an engineer. So I am not somebody who can comment on the safety of individual buildings. But my comment would simply be that it doesn't matter what building you are in, having a few seconds of warning and having that plan, that emergency plan, so you know where the safe zones are and where to move are, that's the right thing to be doing.
So that's a larger discussion that we're going to punt for tonight, Karen. Karen. Thanks for your email. Again, to reintroduce the program, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're speaking about early earthquake warning systems for the West Coast with our guests, Dr. Richard Allen of UC Berkeley and Dr. Harvey Feinberg of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. The number to dial to join our conversation, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So let's get into the technology now. So tell me, what is the technology, Richard Allen, that is being developed or is almost ready for prime time, as it were?
Well, this is really a synergy of sort of new science, as in the understanding of the earthquake process, combined with communications technology. It's the synergy of those two things. The new science that really kicked this off is the recognition that we can very rapidly estimate how big an earthquake is going to be. So it's important to remember that there are literally thousands of earthquakes every single day in California, tiny, tiny earthquakes that we can't feel, but that our sensors detect all the time. And so what is key is being able to distinguish these small earthquakes from the big earthquakes that really matter and being able to do it very quickly. And how quickly we can make that distinction determines how accurate the warning system is and how much warning you can have. So the new science was when we started to understand that you could, in fact, estimate the magnitude with a surprising reliability with just a few seconds of data. That was new at the time when we sort of first recognized that about a decade ago at this point. And so the technology that is then that's combined with is the communications piece. First of all, of course, it seems obvious to us now. We all have phones that are connected to data systems that provide all kinds of information in real time. But about a decade ago was when we were first starting to communicate and pass the real-time seismic data around very rapidly. And so it was a combination of this science, understanding the process, understanding the signal, with the communication to receive the data. And then, of course, the idea that you could push out a warning, again, a type of communication, out to people all in a fraction of a second. And so that's really kind of the synergy of the two things. And then the final piece, of course, is this P-wave and S-wave distinction that we talked about a little bit earlier, that we can use this low amplitude energy at the beginning of the earthquake, through a few seconds of that low amplitude energy, to estimate the strength of the shaking that's going to follow.
And my understanding is that the way the earthquake waves move, they move more slowly than the signal you'll be sending out to people.
Right.
So that's what actually gives you the advantage.
Right. The way to think of it is as lightning. So when you see the flash of lightning, that's like us sending out the alert, and then you hear the sound of the lightning later, just because sound waves travel much more slowly. It's the same principle. Think of the sound waves as being the S waves traveling through the Earth's surface. That's bringing the shaking, but we can send out the alert at the speed of light, and that gives you the time that is the warning. That also comes to the key distinction between how much warning you have. The amount of warning you have is really determined by how far you are from the epicenter of the earthquake. So if you're very close to the event, then you get a very short warning time. And depending on how deep the earthquake is and how quickly the system operates, it's possible that people right at the epicenter may not get a warning. So that we call that the blind zone, a region very close to the epicenter where there's no warning. But then as you get further and further away, you get more and more warning. And that's how you get up to the minutes worth of warning.
Mm. And is there any hope that the people that are closest to the epicenter, which I don't know enough about the how earthquakes work, are the places that are closest to the epicenter the places that sustain the most damage?
So the places closest to the epicenter do have some of the strongest shaking, but not all of the strongest shaking. So when it comes to the strength of shaking you're going to experience in an earthquake, it comes down to several factors. It comes down to the magnitude of the earthquake. Of course, the bigger the magnitude, the stronger the shaking. It then comes down to the distance that you are from the fault, as opposed to the distance from the epicenter. Mm-hmm. So in a big earthquake, think of an earthquake rupturing down the San Andreas Fault. How close you are to the San Andreas Fault is what matters, not where the earthquake started on the San Andreas Fault, which would be the epicenter. And then the last thing, of course, is the type of ground that you're on. Whether you're on solid rock, means lower shaking, Unconsolidated sediments, landfill, means stronger shaking. So those are the three factors that control the strength of shaking. And then the amount of warning time is how far you are from the epicenter. And so that's why for some really big earthquakes, for example, a magnitude 8 earthquake on the San Andreas Fault, imagine it coming down the San Andreas Fault from the north, you could have very strong shaking here in San Francisco because we're very close to the fault, but we could have more than a minute's worth of warning time.
Okay. So it's pretty complicated, all of this, but you're doing a great job sort of simplifying it. So the communication piece, so that's using cellular technology?
Right. So the idea is that we would push out the warning in as many ways as possible. The way that everybody thinks about, of course, is getting the warning on your cell phone. And in fact, we already have an app that sort of to demonstrate the capabilities of the system, this prototype system that we have operating right now, that pushes out the warning to people's cell phones. And so I think one of the main ways that people would receive the warning when this becomes a public system is through their cell phone. And there's no question that's the way that everybody wants to receive the warning, is the cell phone. It has an advantage that the cell phone can also wake you up. It can alert you in the middle of the night, whereas pushing it out through other, perhaps more traditional kinds of approaches, out through TV, out through radio, that's also valuable, of course, and we should also be doing that, but it doesn't have the capability of waking you up.
And where are we at with the capacity of our cell systems to really be able to take this on?
So this is a question that there's not a clear answer to at this point. Right now, most cellular communications, they use point-to-point type of communication. So that means that a central server would have to connect to every single cell phone. And you can imagine that that can take some time, potentially more time than you would want it to. However, as the communications industry becomes aware of early warning, they are now thinking very hard about how they can modify their systems so you could push out a warning much more rapidly. And again, in Japan, we used the example of Japan earlier, they've already been through this process. More than half of their cell phone industry provides the warning in this broadcast mode so that everybody gets the warning at exactly the same point in time. So that's clearly where we need to get to.
And Harvey Feinberg, is there funding for this, the cellular technology as well, or is it just for the technology to assess the risk and then decide that a signal needs to be sent out?
As far as I know, and Richard may have a better idea of this, the annual figure that was developed of about a $16 million cost and the $38 million cost of establishing the infrastructure for the system did not include a cellular broadcast function. But Richard may know that more accurately than I.
You know, Harvey's spot on. That's right. The $38 million capital investment and $16 million operations was to run the seismic network and the infrastructure that would gather that information and generate the kernel of the alert. And so the idea was that that's the piece that we really need to bring together all of these state, federal agencies to make that work, generate the kernel of the alert. But then the intent is to look to the private sector to deliver the warnings to people. Already there is a market out there developing to do that. There are several companies who are developing apps to issue the alerts, who are developing other kinds of devices to issue the alerts. And so I think that there's really lots of evidence that the private sector can take this on and frankly could do a much better job than a group of seismologists.
And Harvey Feinberg, it sounded like you wanted to say something there.
I was just going to add that with all of the competition between different cellular providers, this could be a marketing advantage to be able to offer this service to your subscribers.
Okay. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Let's go to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Ruth Ann, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very, very much. I value this program. I, for one, value an early warning system because I'm disabled. I was in a traumatic accident like 20, 25 years ago, and if I had had some sort of warning and could have avoided the whole thing, it would have been dynamite. And towards that end, I have retrofitted that earthquake-proofed my home so that boom insurance, earthquake insurance rates came out. It turned out to be much cheaper to earthquake-proof my home than to get several years of earthquake insurance. But my question, which you've already addressed, is that I don't know how I would get notified. I don't own a cell phone. I don't own a smartphone. And I was worried. And then I heard you address it, and I said, they're going to do it through smartphones.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Ruth Ann, for your call. Let's get some ideas from our guests about what other ways we can get that type of signal out to someone like you.
Yeah, so in addition, so smartphones, of course, is one that's very popular, although not for Ruth, clearly. Also, radio and TV is another. But there's also a whole plethora of other kinds of devices that people are likely to develop. Again, this is because we've seen this happen in Japan, where people actually buy a device that gets the alert. And it's a dedicated device, just like you might buy a weather station that tells you what the weather's going to be. This is an earthquake station. It gives you the earthquake warning. So some examples of that are there's a company that is developing, it's kind of like the weather radios, actually, the NOAA weather radios. So it's like a little radio that you plug in, and the radio message gets sent out, your radio picks it up, and you get the alert. Also, another area that's sort of growing is sort of home security system, in-home, you know, intelligent house systems are very interested in this. So when you have a home alarm or a home sensor network, you know, CO2 sensors and things like that, adding this capability to that system has an appeal. Potentially, they could also add actual sensors, seismometers, to low-cost seismometers to the system that could, in fact, contribute data in the future to a future generation of an early warning system. So in-home security systems like that is another way. So I think that there are many ways that this can get out, and it's clearly going to be market-driven. And we very much hope that market will drive multiple entities to come up with neat little technological devices to do this.
So let's go next to Tom in Point Richmond. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to talk to you. Yeah, I'd like to know what states other than the 39 states are not at earthquake risk?
Thanks for your call, Tom. Perhaps Tom is considering just moving as his earthquake preparedness strategy. Go ahead, Richard.
I'm not going to try and name which ones are not. I'm going to tell you where the hazards are. I am a geologist better than a geographer, I guess. So the hazards from earthquakes are all associated with the tectonic activity, both the present-day tectonic activity and the tectonic activity of the past. And so the greatest hazard is all along the West Coast, because that's the active plate margin. And so California, for strike slip, San Andreas-type stuff, Oregon and Washington is the subduction zone. And then as you go further east, the hazard is reduced, but there are hotspots. For example, the New Madrid seismic zone is a region where there were 3 magnitude 8 earthquakes in 1811 and 1860. If I'm remembering correctly. And so there are some hotspots throughout other parts of the country. Another example of one of these hotspots, in fact, you may remember there was an earthquake in Virginia a few years ago. It shocked people up and down the East Coast. It was felt from Boston all the way, I'm not sure how far south. It was felt in Boston. It was felt in New York. It was felt in Washington, D.C. It was the big city that it was closest to, damaged the Washington Monument. So seismic activity is distributed throughout much of the U.S. It's not just confined to the West Coast.
Oh, and we just got a call from someone who did not identify themselves to let Ruth Ann know, if you're still listening, Ruth Ann, that as a disabled person, you're eligible for a free cell phone and sees signs for this on BART. So perhaps you can avail yourself of a cell phone should you have no other reason to be opposed to the technology by finding out what free resources that might be available to you. Harvey Feinberg, you mentioned the 39 states. Do you want to give us some more clues about which parts of the country are relatively safer when it comes to earthquake risk?
You've got two states that have relatively few earthquakes are Florida and North Dakota, but then you have hurricanes and blizzards to put up with.
Okay, so you got to sort of decide what you're up for. Okay, thanks for that. Again, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're speaking with Dr. Richard Allen, director of the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory and professor and chair of the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley, and Dr. Harvey Feinberg, president of the Gordon Betty Moore Foundation, which is a major private funder for California's early earthquake warning system. Again, the number to dial to join join our conversation, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So let's hear a little bit more, Richard Allen, about